Here it is!
From deep inside your radio.
So they've got three different forms of digital recording running right now here in this facility at WWNO in New Orleans. And somebody picked the version that had digital glitches to play back last week. Isn't it interesting? It's a choice. Ladies and gentlemen, the Gulf Coast oil mess. It's off the coast. It keeps drifting. One outside the New Orleans area might wonder, well, how does it really impact people here, aside from the fact that folks are lining up to get what they think may be the last oysters? Well, whenever there's a breeze from the east, wherever that is, people in New Orleans don't know directions very well, but it appears to be the east, you have the delightful experience of getting up in the morning and you wake up and smell the oil. It's probably the volatile components of the oil. It's not the oil itself. It's the benzene and the toluene and the whateverine moving this way. So that's one. And then today, on the way over to the Louisiana Lesotho, there was a waterfowl. I believe it was a goose. Do they have geese here? Yeah, they've got geese here. So it was probably a goose. It was the size of a goose. Sitting, occasionally standing, looking around in the, what they call here the neutral ground, the median strip to those of you in America, in the middle of Rampart Street. Just sitting, standing, looking around, like, where the hell? Now, maybe Rampart Street divides the Treme neighborhood from the French Quarter. So maybe it was sitting there thinking, am I a fan of the TV show or would I rather go to Bourbon Street? But it's probably, it's right across the street from a gas station. Maybe it was just, well, I smell like this, so maybe I should go there. Ladies and gentlemen, if you want some perspective on the oil thing, why not ask Tony Hayward, the chief executive of BP? He said in an interview with a British newspaper, nice choice, Tony, that the mess in the Gulf is relatively tiny compared with, quote, the very big ocean. Well, why not take a crap in it while you're at it, Tony? Now, you do know that the original company estimate of 1,000 barrels a day was trumped by the federal government's estimate of 5,000 barrels a day, which the New York Times reported Friday was based on a mathematical formula that is explicitly not advised to be used with major oil spills. And scientists and interested lay people with access to satellite imagery are now estimating anywhere from 60,000 barrels a day is the pace of the oil spill, but it's a very big ocean. The Gulf of Mexico is a very big ocean, he says. The amount of volume of oil and dispersant we're putting into it is tiny related to the total water volume. So I hope that reassures the goose. It's sauce for the goose, as a matter of fact. Ladies and gentlemen, how are we doing with the whole AFPAC thing? We're out soon, right? Weren't we promised that? 2011, gone. Out the door, diddly-or. For the next 5 to 10 years, the U.S. military likely will remain engaged in the same kinds of conflicts it's been fighting since 2001. That's just the opinion of the Marine Corps Vice Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, James Cartwright. General James Cartwright. No one I know, he says, thinks we'll be out of these kinds of conflicts anytime soon. Does he know the president? There's nothing out there. By the way, where is that? Out there. Keep hearing about that place. Can't find it. There's nothing out there that tells us we won't be wrapped up in these conflicts for as far as the eye can see. The quotes get better as you go deeper into the story, don't they? In coming years, the military might be tasked with fighting these kinds of wars in different places and at different levels. He didn't point to specific nations into which U.S. forces or assets might be deployed over the next decade. Beyond Iraq, and Assad. Defense Secretary Gates told reporters earlier in the week that he doubts Washington will soon launch another protracted operation like the ones in Iraq and Afghanistan, partly because of the high cost of such missions. But the Marine Corps General, the Vice Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, says the U.S. Defense Department must change how it goes about buying weapon systems. We don't pay too much and get things that don't work? Why would we do that? If DOD continues pursuing expensive weapons packed with countless advanced subsystems, he says, it will be able to afford only a handful of each. This approach, he says, unless corrected, has the U.S. military on a path toward lacking enough ships and aircraft to be in all the many places we want to be. We need quantity more than quality. Well, given the amount of quality we've been getting, let's try quantity. What do you say? Hello, welcome to the show. From the banks, well, from just off the banks of Lake Pontchartrain, New Orleans, Louisiana, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. And now, ladies and gentlemen,
high def, low def, no def, take my hand. It's a digital wonderland.
A letter from Michael will follow in a moment.
Got to be so careful where you stand in the digital wonderland.
Dear Harry, Michael writes, prior to digital television, we were told that we're covered if we already have cable. I have Comcast cable in San Francisco, and since digital switchover, Comcast has been converting channels from analog to digital QAM. That's an encoding codec. So they're no longer accessible with analog tuners. So I had to go buy a digital QAM tuner. Then last week, Comcast encrypted all the QAM channels, rendering my QAM tuner useless. To add salt to this insult, Comcast is encrypting the C-SPAN channels paid for by our tax dollars. In hindsight, cable users were covered with BS. We must now pay extra for a Comcast desktop box, or set-top box, which was not required for basic and extended basic service prior to the digital wonderland. Thank you, Michael. You could turn it off. Ladies and gentlemen, it's clean, it's safe, it's safe, it's chief. It's too peep to pape him. It's nuclear power. A federal agency on Wednesday disputed New Jersey's suggestion that it did not strongly address a radiation spill at a nuclear power plant in New Jersey last year. The state's Department of Environmental Protection has invoked New Jersey's Spill Act to oversee the cleanup of 180,000 gallons of irradiated water that leaked from the Oyster Creek plant a year ago. That marked the first time New Jersey took the action against one of the state's four nuclear power plants, despite the fact that plants in Salem County have experienced more dangerous and more recent tritium leaks than the one at Oyster Creek. Typically, the law forces change cleanups of pollution. The State Department of Environmental Protection criticized the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Invoking the Spill Act allows the state not only to oversee the cleanup, but also run it. The nuclear regulatory spokesman said the state's view was incorrect. It's a little more complicated than that. The main things were identifying the sources of the leakage, halting it, and considering a remediation plan. The reality is they're still working on the remediation plan. Sound familiar? He didn't say that. The spokesman for Nuclear Regulatory Commission says the plant's owner, Exelon, drilled 14 wells to examine the extent of the contamination. Once the scope of the plume was known, the company and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission planned to identify the best way to address it. Sound familiar? The state said it stepped in when it learned that radiation-tainted water had leached into the Cohansey Aquifer, a vast underground reservoir of drinking water serving more than 1 million residents in southern New Jersey. Once it affected our aquifer, we could not wait for Exelon or anyone else to come up with a plan. That's why we interceded, said the state official. We will have a plan to deal with this leak. Exelon will have to follow the plan we provide. It's just drinking water. But it's not just USA. Deadline Mumbai, the radioactive contamination at one of the facilities at the Baba Atomic Research Center, BARC is its acronym. It's the cradle of Indian nuclear R&D. Over the last few months, there have been several minor incidents and security breaches in nuclear facilities across India. This is a new addition. These incidents come at a time when there's intense political debate over the bill to limit the liability, the financial liability, of nuclear plant owners. Just like the limitation on liability of deep water oil drillers. It's of a piece, don't you think? It's a system. The minor radioactive contamination was the fifth incident involving nuclear safety and security in India in recent times. Depleted uranium was found from three persons in adjoining townships near Mumbai, apparently stolen from one of the nuclear establishments in the country. That's last December 8th. And some incidents of suicides by employees of the Baba Atomic Research Center have been recorded. That's probably coincidental. Deadline Beijing, China. This is such good news, ladies and gentlemen, on the nuclear tip, because we know how safe it is to have nuclear facilities, how reassuring it is to all of us to have nuclear facilities in Pakistan. What could possibly? China has agreed to build two new civilian nuclear reactors in Pakistan. Chinese companies will build at least two new 650-megawatt reactors in Punjab province. China began building a reactor in 1991 and broke ground on a second one. Oh, the ground is broken in 2005. That'll be completed next year. Financing of the two new reactors was agreed by China and Pakistan way back in February. The Financial Times of London quoted an expert as saying China likely felt emboldened to go ahead with the Pakistan deal after the United States signed a civilian nuclear agreement with Pakistan's arch-rival India in 2008. That facilitated cooperation between the United States and India despite India's refusal to sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which Pakistan hasn't signed either. So it's a cool region. It's soon to be a hot region. And a British nuclear risk expert has warned that terrorists could target radioactive waste being transported thousands of miles across Australia. This is apropos because Australia is considering a proposed nuclear waste dump in the Northern Territory on Aboriginal land. Yeah, I wrote that sounds like something I wrote in a book once. John Large advises governments, companies, and non-governmental agencies. He says the waste that will be taken to the remote site, the disused Muckety cattle station, is suitable for use in a dirty radioactive bomb that could be built with limited knowledge. Experts acknowledge a homemade radioactive bomb is the most likely terrorist threat, he said. He said transporting waste by land routes is prone to accident, open to a malicious act, and requires additional packaging and handling for transportation. He said it would be a prime target for terrorists. The move to build the dump comes despite objections from Aboriginal traditional owners in the area who have challenged the right of one family clan to offer a 1.5 square kilometer site in return for $11 million in cash. The committee ignored a number of warnings about the risk of transporting nuclear waste and suggestions it be stored close to the point of its production. Because it's clean, it's safe, it's cheap. It's too clean to be safe. It's nuclear power. And it does sound so much. It is of a piece, isn't it? It's what we do because we want more lights and more fridges. And now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week. I should sound more excited about that, shouldn't I?
We're so sorry.
Okay. I will. On Friday, Google made a stunning admission. For over 3 years, it has inadvertently connected snippets of private information that people send over unencrypted wireless phone networks. The admission made in an official blog by Alan Eustace, Google's engineering chief, comes a month after regulators in Europe started asking the search giant pointed questions about Street View, the layer of real-world photographs accessible from Google Maps. Google is saying in a late-night Friday European time confession that is sure to infuriate regulators and privacy advocates that its previous claims that it explicitly did not collect or store so-called payload data, the actual information being transmitted by users, is wrong. Eustace wrote that a review of Street View software has revealed that due to a programming error in 2006, the company has indeed been mistakenly collecting samples of payload data, the actual stuff you're transmitting over your unprotected Wi-Fi network. Only in Europe, in the United States, and other major regions around the world, however. In his blog post, Mr. Eustace said of the Google engineering team, "We are profoundly sorry for this error and are determined to learn all the lessons we can from our mistakes." There's another Google apology coming up. But meanwhile, a Houston teacher who was recorded on cell phone video beating a student apologized this week, saying she was without excuse for the attack on the 13-year-old. Science teacher Sherry Lynn Davis, who was fired by the charter school because of the attack, says she regrets what happened and would act much differently if given the opportunity. I apologize for the pain the result of this situation has brought, she said. At her lawyer's office, I apologize for this particular incident. She took no questions about her attack on Isaiah Reagans at Jamie's House Charter School, a Houston alternative school. Reagan suffered a black eye and other bruises in the attack. His mother has filed a lawsuit. Paul Levy, chief executive of Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston, said this week that senior staff and hospital board members warned him for years about the pitfalls of his longtime close relationship with a female employee, but for reasons he does not fully understand, he ignored their advice. In his first interview about the controversy, Levy said he made a big mistake by believing he could hire and employ his close personal friend for years at Harvard's teaching hospital without upsetting other employees and potentially damaging the reputation of the institution. He does not believe charitable funds were misspent because the woman filled needed jobs, did good work, and was highly qualified, even though she had no hospital experience when he hired her right out of graduate school. He did apologize. I'm trying to find the apology, the exact wording of the apology, but during, speak among yourselves, ladies and gentlemen. I've been in public service around 40 years, and although I've made mistakes along the way, this is probably the worst one I've ever made because of the effect it's had on people here at the hospital who've come to rely on me. I know the hurt and disappointment is going to remain. Although what I did didn't cause harm to a particular person, it caused harm to the institution. This was, it's kind of an apology. Didn't really say sorry, did you? Did you, Mr. Levy, Dr. Levy? Dateline Wellington, New Zealand. New Zealand's leader did apologize this week for joking he would have been part of the meal had he attended dinner with a Maori tribe whose history includes cannibalism. Prime Minister John Key's quip further soured relations with the people that are already strained over their bid to win back ownership of tribal lands confiscated by a settler government 150 years ago. Later in the day, after making the remark, Kay apologized. It was a lighthearted joke, a bit of self-deprecating humor. But if anyone is offended, then I deeply apologize, he said in a strange accent. Dateline Bangalore, India. Google's Gmail went down this week in India. And media reports said it went down on May 11th. And Google apologized for the inconvenience. We apologize for the inconvenience and thank you for your patience and continued support, said. So, two for Google. United Airlines has apologized to a blind woman from Vancouver Island who was deserted on an empty plane in Chicago. Jessica Cabot from Courtney, B.C., went public about being forgotten in an empty United Airlines plane on an April 7th stopover in Chicago. The 18-year-old was waiting for flight attendants to escort her to a connecting flight to Florida when she heard the plane door slam shut. 10 minutes later, two maintenance staff happened to find her on an unscheduled check of the plane. She was panicked in the plane, calling for help. For her trouble, Cabot received a $250 airline voucher and 5 weeks after her flight and a series of news stories, an apology. The International Civil Aviation Organization, ICAO, has formally apologized to Iran for altering the nomenclature of the Persian Gulf in one of its publications. ICAO provoked a storm of criticism in Tehran after it used the term Arabian Gulf to refer to the body of water historically known as the Persian Gulf. ICAO called the slip-up a mistake that will never happen in the future. A UN manual on the standardization of geographical names has banned any attempt to alter or distort a historically registered name, saying it is, quote, unlawful. Ouch. Newcastle, Australia's Catholic Bishop, Michael Malone, sent an extraordinary letter of apology this week. It's been applauded by child sex abuse victims, but they condemned the continuing silence from other clergy who had roles in the attempted secret defrocking of pedophile priest Dennis McLinden in 1995. So, that goes on. Pedophile priests in Australia. Who could have imagined that? Dateline London, a British retailer. I'm just saying. It's all over the place. Dateline London, a British retailer apologized for labeling underwear tops aimed at young girls as bra tops, but said it will continue to stock the items. The garments for 6 to 8 year old girls including a heart pattern design and a lace trim design, were previously marketed by Marks & Spencer as, a quote, a great way of getting girls used to the idea of wearing bras, but backed off the description after objections from child protection groups who campaigned to combat the trend toward the sexualization of children. Officials with Marks & Spencer say the tops aren't bras and apologize for the way they've been labeled. See you at the beauty pageant, kids. Dateline Wilson, North Carolina. Wilson County Sheriff is again asking for forgiveness for comments he made after losing the primary election last week to a former sheriff's deputy and a State Bureau of Investigation agent. Wayne Gay, Sheriff Gay, blamed a racial divide in the county for his loss. He's white, while his opponent, Calvin Woodard, is black and told a crowd of supporters he would work to help another candidate defeat Woodard. Gay later said he apologized to Woodard and in a letter published in a local paper wrote that he let down the public for his election night comments. He explained he was livid because of vicious rumors about his family and comments referring to some of his black supporters as, quote, lackeys, unquote. A right-wing blogger who mocked the suffering of cancer-afflicted film critic Roger Ebert has apologized, blaming political partisanship, the vitriolic atmosphere of Twitter, and excessive consumption of vodka. Well, one out of three is right. Pacific Gas and Electric Company has apologized for the second time in a week to Marin County customers in Northern California, this time for mistakenly sending a letter to 6,000 customers that included information on how to opt out of Marin's independent electric power program and rejoin PG&E. The letter that reminded Marin customers that, quote, as a new electricity supplier, Marin Energy Authority has not previously engaged in buying and selling electricity, and PG&E provides no guarantee of the CCA's financial or operational capability. It was sent to every customer who will automatically be opted in to the Marin program. In a press release, PG&E's senior vice president said the letter should not have been sent out. We apologize to every customer who received its letter. It should never have been sent. We are now looking into how this happened and how to prevent it from happening again in the future. A congressional candidate is backpedaling from a joke posted on a webpage about hunting liberals at some voters in the 11th district of California found offensive. Vineyard owner Brad Gehring, a Lodi Republican candidate, posted this on his Facebook page. Quote, if I could issue hunting permits, I would officially declare today opening day for liberals. The season would extend through November 2 and have no limits on how many taken, as we desperately need to thin the herd. Unquote. Gehring campaign manager Carl Fogliani said the post was misunderstood. I think it's pretty obvious he's talking about elections. Gehring apologized for his comments in a follow-up post. I intended to include the wording we would use votes and not bullets, but hit the share button by accident before I finished and decided to leave it thinking it would not be taken in a literal sense. I'm sorry if I confused anyone. Gehring deleted the post a few hours later. Those literal-minded liberals. Dateline, Vermont, the state's Roman Catholic diocese hoping finally to put a painful clerical sexual abuse scandal to rest. In Vermont? Really? Has paid out $17.6 million to settle 26 lawsuits alleging incidents of long-ago child molestation by priests in Vermont. It's catching on. These unfortunate incidents crippled the life of the church, said a somber Bishop Salvatore Matano. He said the diocese agreed to a deal as a way to end the pain the abuse scandal has caused for both the victims and the church. I apologize most sincerely for the pain the victims have suffered, he said. I ask for all of our faithful to pray for our wounded brothers and sisters. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen. Yes, it is a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And in news of potential pending legislation in Louisiana, guns will be allowed in houses of worship as a way to protect worshipers from attacks if the pastor or head of the religious body approves. According to the Louisiana House, voting 74-18 for a bill that they will send to the Senate, the sponsor says the bill is a matter of choice and leaves it up to each synagogue, mosque, or church to decide whether to implement it. Each church in Louisiana will still be gun-free, as state law now dictates, unless a house of worship decides to allow certain members qualified to carry concealed weapons to bring them to church. Well, it's back
direct from the electronic trading floor of Corium Slocum Oliver, this is Mind Your Own Business. I'm Mike Tuccinello on the virtual trading floor. Greece is in the skillet and all of Europe is trying to turn down the flame on the stove of debt. And the main cook in that economic kitchen is Germany. We all know what that means, something indigestible in the financial system of the Eurozone. While savvy investors flee the bonds of Europe like a new arrival at Ellis Island, they're also warily eyeing the financial status of good old Uncle Sam. The Chinese, with their own housing bubble staring them straight down the barrel, are beginning to wonder if it's time to sell some of their trillions in U.S. debt. And if that happens, the savvy investor will be heading for the fruit cellar for the summer. President Obama declared it a ridiculous spectacle, the drama of three companies fighting over responsibility for the oil mess in the Gulf of Mexico. And over at the Money Honey Desk, Sylvia Meal Argent has the newly appointed head of British Petroleum's Task Force Gulf Cleanup now as her guest.
Thanks, Mike. Simon Pants took over his position at BP just this week after spearheading other corporate rescue operations, including the notorious Latin American launch of Yellow Coke just last year. Simon, I guess you hit the water running.
Or sliding. Thanks, Sylvia. Yes, indeed. Difficult time to come on board, but that's what we in the corporate rescue design field do.
You first gained fame in the industry when you tackled the problem of tainted mouthwash in Canada.
That's correct. Somehow we never really found out how salmonella had contaminated all of the large bottles of Minterine, which at the time was Canada's best-selling mouthwash, absolutely owned the market for green mouthwash, which at the time was the largest segment of the Canadian mouthwash sector.
Well, how did you extricate Minterine from that near disaster?
Easier than it sounded. We changed the color to blue and spent $100 million convincing Canadians that blue mouthwash was better than green.
Well, nothing that easy in the Gulf of Mexico, I'd imagine.
I shouldn't think so, no. An unfortunate series of false starts, I'm afraid, rather put the company on the back foot, as we say.
Which means?
Off the front foot, I should think.
So far, everything your company has tried to stop the discharge of oil seems to have failed. Is this impacting the brand?
Well, it is. It can't help but do, and so we're taking a very proactive approach. You may recall BP did a virtual renaming a few years back when we were positioned as pro-environmental. Mm-hmm. We branded BP as Beyond Petroleum.
But recently you've returned to the legacy name.
We have. And now it's associated in the public mind, our research tells us, with a certain degree of hubris, of arrogance, and of haplessness. We feel our most urgent need is to recast the company brand once more. And we're going to be doing that starting this week with some creative that really takes advantage of our British heritage to assume a self-deprecating approach that can add some needed humility to the corporate personality with understated humour, as only the Brits can do.
Mm-hmm.
So for the duration of this episode, we'll be rebranding the company. British Petroleum is now Twittish Petroleum, and the early research on that is very good indeed.
Humour plays well in dealing with a crisis?
Well, obviously, that's not the only arrow in our quiver.
Mm-hmm.
We've had quite a large virtual conversation on our corporate network on our new plans to stanch the flow of oil following the failure of the containment dome and the top hat.
And the junk shot.
Well, we never really tried that. It was a trial balloon floated in the media, and that's gone back to the science shop for renaming.
The word junk was a turnoff?
It sounded as if we were dumping garbage in the Gulf, and I mean, who would do that?
Mm-hmm.
So in the queue for announcements this week are the turkey neck, so named because of the curved and wizened appearance of the pipe that protrudes from the underwater pump,
mm-hmm.
the tourniquet, which would literally attempt to constrict the pipe at the wellhead to strangle the leak, and the blind date.
And that is?
An underwater robot that inserts a probe into wherever it finds a weakness in the well structure.
Besides the place where it's leaking.
But yes, precisely, not as weak as that point. Now, obviously, there's no guarantee that any of these procedures will succeed. In fact, our financial department is shorting the company's stock as a way of hedging that expectation of failure. And that's where we think the self-deprecation of Twittish Petroleum will, we think, inoculate us against more of a sense of failure. You know, one of the signature lines we're considering, if these procedures go pear-shaped, is, what do you expect from the Brits?
Does that attitude extend to BP's stance toward demands for greater and greater expenditures to compensate people and communities damaged by the leak?
Well, legal is spearheading that. It's not in my remit, but I do understand from the conference calls that they're adopting a slightly more robust posture in regard to possible litigation, which lead counsel described to me as cutting the plaintiffs off at the knees.
So, a dichotomy.
Well, corporate versatility. Mm-hmm. The finest orchestra in the world plays at more than one tempo.
Simon Pants, head of Task Force Golf Cleanup Now, thanks for joining us on the virtual trading floor.
Thank you, Sylvia. It's very quiet here.
Very. Mike?
And for now, that's Mind Your Own Business for this week. Next time, the growth market and home foreclosures. Till then, I'm Mike Tuccinello saying, this week, mind the business of someone you love. So long.
This is Le Show, and now, ladies and gentlemen, the news from outside the bubble. A leading Israeli airport security expert says the Canadian government, among others, has wasted millions of dollars to install, quote, useless, unquote, imaging machines at airports across the country. I don't know why everybody is running to buy these expensive and useless machines. I can overcome the body scanners with enough explosives to bring down a Boeing 747, Rafi Sella told parliamentarians probing the state of aviation safety in Canada. That's why we haven't put them in our airports in Israel, he said, referring to Ben Gurion International, which has some of the toughest security in the world. Sella is a former chief security officer of the Israeli Airport Authority and a 30-year veteran in airport security and defense technology. He helped design the security at Ben Gurion Airport. He said he wouldn't reveal how to get past the virtual strip search scanners, but said he can provide briefings to officials with security clearance. Canada this year bought 44 body scanners. And, of course, the U.S. is... Well, isn't Michael Chertoff a lobbyist for the company that... On a similar note, Tel Aviv University professor and noted military analyst Reuven Peretzur strongly criticized a ballistic missile defense conference and exhibition held in Tel Aviv. Calling the organizers and speakers claims that current defense systems can protect Israel from missile and rocket threats false and disingenuous. So that's 0-2. Meanwhile, the U.S. air base at Bagram in Afghanistan contains a facility for detainees that is distinct from its main prison, the Red Cross confirmed to the BBC this week. 9 former prisoners have told the BBC they were held in a separate building and subjected to abuse. The U.S. military says the main prison, now called the detention facility, is the only detention facility on the base. However, it is said it will look into the abuse allegations made to the BBC. The International Committee of the Red Cross said since August of last year, U.S. authorities have been notifying it of names of detained people in a separate structure at Bagram. Federal investigators have determined that a page was removed from the Fire Boss book at Massey Energy's Upper Big Branch mine, where 29 workers were killed a month ago in the worst U.S. coal mining disaster in 40 years. That's according to a new court filing by lawyers for the families of two of the miners who died. U.S. Mine Safety and Health Administration officials revealed this potentially important piece of information to the families during a closed-door meeting last week. And that's only available that I've seen on a West Virginia newspaper blog, almost outside the bubble. And fury erupted in eastern Afghanistan this week, according to The Guardian, after U.S. soldiers were once again accused of killing civilians during a night raid on a private house. That's the sound of hearts and minds being one you hear in the background. The assault on the compound in the village of a name I'm not even going to try to pronounce, ladies and gentlemen, but it's in Nangarhar province, occurred about 1 a.m., leaving several people dead. Officials said it was an intelligence-led operation and that 8 people had been killed during a shootout, including a Taliban sub-commander. Weapons, they said, had been recovered from the compound. That's not how the incident was described by family members, neighbors, and the local population, 500 of whom demonstrated outside the office of the governor of the district. One person was reported by locals to have been killed, 2 injured after the crowd tried to enter the government buildings. A spokesman for the provincial governor said 14 civilians had been murdered and 3 injured. He said local authorities had started an investigation and had been in contact with U.S. forces, who are usually responsible for mounting night raids. The Afghan president, Hamid Karzai, has called for a ban on night raids. Stanley McChrystal, our commander of the NATO forces, has taken steps to reduce the number of night raids. He says they're one of the key causes of anger towards foreigners. A relative of the dead who lives in the same village said it was widely assumed the Americans were using weak intelligence. The leading theory among villagers was that spies or simply disgruntled locals had fed false information to the United States military. News from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. In case you missed it, on a totally other subject, the conservative columnist and commentator Pat Buchanan this week pointed out that if Elena Kagan is confirmed to her post on the Supreme Court, Jews, who represent less than 2% of the population, will have 33% of the Supreme Court seats. He asks, is this the Democrats' idea of diversity? The folks who look more like the real targets of liberal bias, he says, are white Protestants and Catholics. Not in living memory has a Democratic president nominated an Irish, Italian, or Polish Catholic. What happened, he asked, to the party of the Dalys, Ritzos, and Rostenkowskis? And not in nearly half a century has a Democratic president nominated a white Protestant or white Catholic, man or woman. 3 Jews on the Supreme Court. Subject for more discussion moments from now here on the show.
Once there was a thing called spring. When the world was writing verses like yours and mine, all the lads and girls would sing. When we sat at little tables and drank May wine. Now April, May, and June are sadly out of tune. Life has stuck the pin in the bud. Spring is here. Why doesn't my heart entrancing. No desire, no ambition leads me. Maybe it's because nobody needs me. Spring is here. Why doesn't the breeze delight me? Stars appear. Why doesn't the night invite me? Maybe it's because nobody loves me. Spring is here, I
CPR, Continental Public Radio, at loggerheads. Conflicting opinions evenly matched according to the diametric system. Today, if Elena Kagan is confirmed, will there be too many Jews on the Supreme Court? From the left, Joan Rivers. From the right, Yakov Smirnoff.
Joan, first time I heard it sounded like a ridiculous topic for debate. I thought only place there could be too many Jews is at a mikveh in Brooklyn. But public radio money was inducement to think again. Supreme Court is a unique institution in American life. They serve for life, insulated from all political pressure, yet major influence on how we live. Only thing like it in Russia is president's in-laws. What a country. So why shouldn't court be more representative of America, more Protestants, more Mormons? If we keep going the way we're going, pretty soon white guys in Supreme Court building will be scarce as orchids in Moscow. In Russia, flowers plant you. Don't get me wrong, I've got nothing against more Jews anywhere. Major League Baseball could use some. In Russia, sports bet on you. For that matter, Branson, Missouri could use some Jews. Justice Ginsburg would give you your own theater. In Russia, theater walk out on you. What a country. I know better than anyone else many Jewish people drawn to legal profession. You need to be smart, very verbal, like to argue to succeed in that work. If you don't believe me, ask my ex-wife. In Russia, ex-wife supports you. I wish. But USA is such a great melting pot, and especially at Supreme Court, we need more in the pot than matzo ball soup. John?
Yakov, first I heard of this topic, I thought, wait a minute, last time I saw this many Jews in robes, it was at the pool of the Doral Hotel. For the Goyim, that's in Miami. But my God, the people who are saying there should be more Protestants on the court, aren't these the same people who hate quotas, who said there shouldn't be fewer black men working in bathrooms? Personally, I'm proud that lawyers practicing in the Supreme Court are going to have to look up with awe and respect to a couple of short Jewish women. Why should Jewish men have all the tzuris? Although God knows they could take a couple of hours out from reading briefs to at least look in a mirror. I mean, Justice Ginsburg, my God, I've heard of dressing like Mother of the Bride, but not Mother of the Corpse. Please. And you know, Yakov, it's not so long ago the court was as much of a no-Jews-allowed zone as the L.A. Country Club. All putts. So we should just relax. In a few years, maybe there'll be two or three Mexican Catholics on the court, and we'll be worrying about closing down the Supreme Court cafeteria because the judges are eating lunch out of a truck. What counts is what's between the ears and between the toes. Ugh, somebody tell Kagan a pedicure wouldn't kill her. From the left, I'm Joan Rivers.
And from the right, I'm Yakov Smirnoff. We both like to be asked to be at loggerheads.
At Loggerheads is produced with help of a grant from the Other Hand Foundation. On the other hand, that's where you'll find us. Next time, another issue that throws off sparks sets the studio ablaze at Loggerheads. This is CPR, Continental Public Radio, public radio for the rest of us.
And just before we leave you, some news of the warm, ladies and gentlemen. In a study published in the journal Science this week, an international team of biologists reports that in more than one-tenth of the places in Mexico where lizards flourished in 1975, no lizards anymore. The researchers predict that by 2080, about 40% of local lizard populations worldwide, around the world, will have died off, and 20% of lizard species will be extinct. That doesn't include agents. The reason for the huge die-off appears to be rising temperatures. Global warming appears to be lengthening the period of the day when lizards must seek shelter or risk fatal overheating. In the breeding season, that sheltering period is now so long that females are unable to eat enough food to produce eggs and offspring. News of the Warm is a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And that's going to conclude this week's edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USEN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet 7.415 megahertz shortwave, on the mighty 104 in Berlin, around the world via the internets, at two different locations, live and archive whenever you want, at harryshearer.com and kcrw.com. Available on your smart throne. Try that. Your smartphone through stitcher.com. Now, I'm just thinking about a smart throne. I'll flush that for you, babe. We got that. Available as a free download to members at audible.com/theshow. And available as a free podcast at kcrw.com. And it'd be just like, given the choice of three digital recordings, they choose the one without the skipping. If you'd agree to join with me then. Would you already? Thank you very much. Uh-huh. The email address for this broadcast and the playlist of the music heard here on. Just a couple of the reasons for visiting harryshearer.com. A tip of the show chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago, In Exile, and Hawaii desks. Thanks, as always, to Pam Halston, and thanks to Bob Dunn for helping to make today's program last almost an hour. The show is on Twitter, at LeTwits. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless.
Hi, everybody. This is Tom Jones, Santa Monica, home of the homeless.
I said that.